We are continuing our journey through essay number 3 here on freedom and responsibility in 1 Corinthians. This is 1 Corinthians 10, verses 14 through 22 that we'll be looking at today. And it's going to be on new covenant, sacrament, and idolatry. And Paul is going to explain that we Christians are to have no identification with idolatry. So the rhetoric of this part is a 7-part ring composition. The topics Paul touches on includes communion, sacrifice, and sacraments. And in the center section, Paul brings up the topic of demons. So it reads, "And therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not participation in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than He?"
Okay, you dug it. Now you figure out how to get out.
So what do you think Paul is trying to communicate to the Corinthian believers here? And what do you think this passage has to do with us?
I don't know if he's for or against.
So in the very first part, first verse there, verse 14, it begins, "therefore." Therefore means that, you know, we probably need to look at what Paul just wrote. And what did Paul write? Well, in the previous, immediately preceding section of this essay, Paul wrote, you know, that talked about the sacraments, the, you know, baptism and communion as contemporary equivalents of the Hebrews walking through the Red Sea and of the provision of manna and the water. But what he said was these sacraments aren't magic, but rather it's about what the sacraments point to that matters. And he basically said, wrote, "Don't let sacraments lead you into idolatry." Now in verse 13, Paul wrote that the Corinthians need not succumb to the temptation of idolatry, and that a way of escape will be made so that they could endure the temptation. And
okay, so my mind's working slow. I don't get the word "and." Paul wrote that the Corinthians need not succumb to the temptation of idolatry, and Paul wrote that the Corinthians, that a way of escape will be made so that they could
endure the temptation. That was verse 13. So it's the verse that begins, "No temptation has overcome you," and so forth and so on. We talked about that last week.
Right. A way of escape will be made so that they could endure the temptation. So the second portion is saying you don't need to succumb. There will be a way of escape.
Right. And here's the way. Flee from idolatry.
Okay.
It's not something that God has to miraculously provide a way. It's the choice. It's a choice of the Christians to flee idolatry.
Turn around and walk away.
So the way you're not going to, the way you escape, just don't go there.
Yeah.
Don't go to God's faith.
The flee from idolatry echoes flee from prostitution. That Paul wrote in chapter 6. And both idolatry and sacred prostitution were found together in Corinth in the pagan temples.
Yeah. It's not the sexual prostitution we see today.
Paul is writing here, though, basically that placing one's self in opposing philosophical and metaphysical home environments, in other words, going to a pagan temple, is a bad move.
I'm saying singing the wrong songs is a bad move.
So,
well, didn't they have sacred sexual prostitution?
Yeah.
There as well? I mean, it's like prostitution of different gods, but it's...
No, that's what prostitution is there. It's not the prostitution we have today. Their prostitution was religious-oriented.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought you were saying it was like having a different... Instead of loving God, you're loving demons. You were saying that was the prostitution, but there was also sexual prostitution going on. Sacred sexual prostitution.
Yeah, that is what we're talking about. Yes.
So is that what Paul is trying to tell the Corinthian believers? That it's a bad idea to place yourself in environments where you are hearing, seeing, and participating in things that will lead you away from God. How does that... mesh with the whole idea of mission, because how do you engage the people who are involved in these things if you don't go to those things?
There's probably other places you would meet them besides in their own worship place.
Now, verse 15 is maybe a little bit of sarcasm from Paul. I speak as to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. I think what he's saying is, if you say you're so knowledgeable and wise, you ought to know what I'm telling you is true. Well, because the Corinthians were proud of their knowledge and their wisdom. And all along now, Paul in this letter has been kind of showing them that, well, your knowledge, your wisdom isn't quite what you say it is. And verse 22, shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? Paul alludes back to what he's been discussing in Hebrew history. Persistence in idolatry in the history of the Hebrews, the Israelites, never ended well. Our problem is, what in the world is idolatry? Well, in our present day context, what is idolatry? Next we go to the next inner ring here. Verses 16, 17, and 21, where the cup and the bread or the cup and the table are mentioned. The key idea here is that the sacraments are participation or communion in some kind of transcendent or mystical reality. Ken Bailey writes, with Jerome Murphy O'Connor and G.G. Findlay, I have translated the Greek word koinonia as communion rather than partnership. The word partnership has an organizational and even a commercial flavor. Communion brings language into the sphere of the holy.
Well, I guess I'm confused on 16, 17. If I read this, I say that Paul says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. Now, if you're sensible people, you'll understand that the cup of the blessing is a form of idolatry, because that's just the blood of Christ. And that the bread is one of his body, that's another form of idolatry. That's what I, in my mind, I see. He is poking fun at them. You're just doing idolatry.
Well, the way it needs to be read is the cup of blessing that we bless, is it not communion in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not communion in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Paul is contrasting.
He's saying it's not that.
True communion with false communion.
God communion and idol communion.
So, me, a Westerner, I threw the baby out with the wash. When it says, flee from idolatry, then I'm going to flee from all
sacraments.
It's not what Paul is saying.
And that's not what
Paul because Paul has, in the previous section of this essay, Paul has already affirmed the value of sacraments, not as something that in themselves create anything new, but rather they are reminders of the past.
So he's not poking fun at people's
Some in Corinth were using communion as a way to keep the church. And we'll get to that in the next essay. Anyway, it's a little further down in the letter, but the rich and the poor were having differences over communion. So this idea of division, which came up at the very beginning of this letter, continues. The communion was being used as a way of dividing. Paul writes that the communion, its rituals and elements, are not spiritual magic. So that was another thing that they may have fought, what we discussed last week in the previous part of this essay. So that the Corinthians may have seen the communion as some kind of magic to allow them, you know, if they participated in communion, then they would be immune from pagan influences.
What's the definition of sacrament? What are sacraments performed for?
Sacraments are those sacred rituals that bring a person that has to do with some kind of drawing a person closer to a deity, a transcendent reality.
So morning meditations could be a sacrament.
Yeah.
And so often in my mind, we think of heathen rituals, heathen practices. But I throw the baby out with the wash. So I throw all sacraments out.
Now, there is a definition of sacrament that is more technical and is applied to the church, where only those who have been authorized are able to offer sacraments.
Then they're putting magic into it.
So what Paul is writing here too is that communion is about active participation in the community of believers. No, it's not something that's passive. You just don't sit there and receive communion. Communion is an active participation. Communion is also supposed to unite individuals into a single community. Christ is one, therefore the church is one. And communion represents the transformation of individuals into Christ's nature. A sentence here from couple sentences from a commentary. Communion in the body of Christ unites us both to Christ and to the church that is his body. Paul wants to ensure that his readers catch this double meaning.
And the church means the body of believers.
The body of believers, the single body of believers. So communion is a reminder, first of all, of Christ. It's a reminder of what he did. But it's also supposed to be participation, a reminder of that believers need to be active participants in present-day community called the church. Paul's problem is that because communion represents a transformation that happens in believers, to participate in pagan sacraments then is to participate in that reality. And you can't do that. A person cannot have two natures. Either belongs to Christ or belongs to demons.
You can't say, like in countries, you're either, you know, you don't, if you can't serve in our army,
I can.
Oh, you can? Okay, well, there must be other analogies that will work here. But you don't say, okay, there's emperor worship. And what I saw in the movie where it was showing emperor worship, I mean, it was a real footage that Americans had taken because they went in on to help them medically with their eyes. Well, did you see that movie with us?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they attributed everything to the emperor just like we do to God. All the blessings, all this medical stuff was because the emperor was so great. You know, they got healed. Medically healed, but they attributed all these blessings to the emperor, and that it was so unusual because it just lit up the fact of how we attribute, as Christians, attribute our blessings to God. Whether, you know, I mean, this doctor performed a surgery, your body heals. But we know God made our bodies to heal, da 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 da. Thank you, God, for healing me. Okay, so, but they, it appeared to be, thank the emperor for their healing. So how could you worship the emperor and worship God? So it's
kind of
like that to me.
Okay. Sacraments are not mere country club type traditions, but they are actually participation in the mystical and spiritual realms. Now, there's a difference between mystical and magical. Mystical deals with the intangible. It deals with indirect evidences of its reality. It's relational, and it allows for unpredictability. Magical, in spite of how its relation to the supernatural frequently, wants things to be tangible. It wants direct evidence. It's ritualistic, and it wants things to be predictable.
The magician is in control.
Yeah. Now, Paul mentions the cup and table in the latter part of this essay. This may be an allusion to Psalm 23, the shepherd's psalm. you recall the shepherd's psalm, Psalm 23, has to do with, you know, the valley of the shadow of death. There's, you know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. It begins kind of very pastoral, but then it descends into danger. It descends into, well, very threatening situations, but it ends with, in spite of all that, the writer trusts in God, and he is looking forward to God setting a table among his enemies. And maybe this is something that Paul is trying to, this allusion that Paul is trying to apply to the Corinthians. What he may be saying is, you are surrounded by all these forces that are against God, but you are able to withstand the temptations. You can participate. You can trust in and participate in what God has for you. You don't have to fear. The cup may represent a vertical communion with God, and the table a horizontal communion with fellow believers. We come to the center now, where Paul writes about, consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or the idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice, they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. So first, another illustration from Hebrew history. The phrase, consider the people of Israel, is literally Israel according to the flesh, and this probably captures better Paul's intent. The opposing statement, if it existed, would be Israel according to the promise. The phrase according to the flesh is Paul's way of saying without faith. Paul, by saying, look at Israel according to the flesh, is also including all those Jews during his time who were offering sacrifices at Jerusalem, but were without faith. In other words, Paul is not commending the Israelites in verse 18 here. When he says, are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in or in communion with the altar? There's no commendation there. What he is saying, writing there, is that they may have gone through God-commanded rituals, all the sacrifices, but their communion was with just a physical object and not the person or the Spirit of God, because they were according to the flesh. Next, Paul talks about pagan sacrifices to idols. So the Gentile believers might have argued that if Israelite sacrifices and participating in associated feasts didn't create a relationship with God, because that's what Paul just said, wrote, why can't they, the Gentiles, participate in pagan rituals and feasts? Now, if it's means nothing, why is Paul forbidding them from participation in pagan rituals and pagan feasts? Well, Paul does agree that idols aren't gods, and that rituals and feasts in themselves don't create a relationship to pagan gods. But within the spiritual realm, there are beings and forces against God. They do exist. And here Paul terms them, those things, as demons. Paul here is not expounding on the nature of demons and demonic activity. He simply accepts their existence and threat. This is what the commentary says about it. This comment is not a full-blown exposition on the demonic, nor is it possible to understand exactly what Paul believed a demon to be, although his thought here is in perfect line with Old Testament passages that identify pagan gods as demons and condemn such sacrifices. Paul's general perceptions and beliefs about the demonic are not clear from this statement, although there is no reason to conclude that he doubted the existence of demons. Nevertheless, scholarly discussions on this verse that enter into denial or defense of the reality of the demonic are off the point. Paul is juxtaposing two levels of concern, two loyalties, and two powers. One power is the power of God manifested in a clear and ultimate form in Jesus Christ, and the other is labeled demons. Paul states plainly that the Corinthian Christians are to be concerned with and involved with only God. There is no room for other affiliations, and the Corinthians are to avoid all possible compromises of their relationship to God. So what does this mean for us?
The crux.
Is understanding this term, idolatry, what is it? No, we don't really identify with it. Oh, we give intellectual explanations, you know, such as, oh, money can be an idol. Well, we give contemporary examples, but we generally don't emotionally relate to it. Now, for the Corinthians, they were emotionally involved with idolatry. So while we intellectually agree that passages like today are important, we tend to dismiss them at the subconscious as irrelevant to our lives. The Corinthians, again, were surrounded by idolatry. It was part of their everyday lives. So the key for us is to try to find something that will connect us emotionally to ancient idolatry and its pervasiveness. So, at least for me this week, as I was struggling and wrestling with what exactly this means, the concept of idolatry as magic seemed to help me. You know, fantasy is a popular genre in today's literature and entertainment. Well, it has been for a long time. Magic seeks to harness and control powers beyond that normally allowed or given to human beings. In other words, magic seeks to harness the power of the gods. It's illegitimate power. Now, gifts, whether they're physical or spiritual, granted by God, are legitimate powers. When God offers spiritual gifts, whether it's healing or speaking in tongues or whatever it is, these sign gifts, using those things would be an appropriate use of power because the person didn't try to grab it from God, but rather God gave it.
Right.
Magic is trying to grab that power for yourself.
So it would be like Satan wanting to be like God. He wanted to be able to do the things God did. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Another thing magic seeks to do by these powers is to tame the unpredictable and the unknown. It's about control. And so how does magic try to work these things? Well, it prescribes detailed rituals, whether they're sacrifices or whether they're creation of potions, whether they're holy foods that a person has to consume, or maybe they're words, or they're incantations, spells, very precisely detailed. You follow these steps, and it allows a human being to access what I've termed illegitimate power. And finally, magic is generally motivated by some element of self-interest. What's in it for me? But in our daily lives, most of us don't deal with magic or idolatry, or do we? Do we desire illegitimate power? What kinds? And how do we seek them? Does modern Christianity ever employ magic? If so, how? How do we seek? Generally, it has to do with trying to control our circumstances. We try to control what happens to us. We try to control people around us. We can use the Bible to control other people. We can use money to control other people, or to try to control ourselves. How we look, how we appear.
So when you give a donation to something, are you giving it with strings attached? Or just merely adding to the fund? So if you are hoping for control by giving, then that might fall under this.
I don't know why, but Norwegians, English, and I'm probably totally wrong, have not gone into mafia, what do you call that?
Organized crime?
Organized society. But we have developed in our United States, we pay our taxes, and if something is written down, and we do that. But in the mafia, organized crime, which there's another term for that that's not always bad, but in undeveloped countries, you pay the piper, you bribe in order to keep your standing. And it's not a bill with a receipt, it's a respect and you give him honor that's not necessarily declared. We have tried to basically eliminate that from our financial structure. But when you give 10% to the mafia, why do you do it? Out of fear.
Yeah.
And it's out of protection, it's right. Insurance. And that's the life that the idolatry is your relationship.
You're trying to control them.
It's not about a loving relationship.
It's fear.
It's not even really a relationship.
But a lot of societies are built on that. And you pay the piper, you pay your percentage to keep the people who are empowered, and they will protect you.
Yeah.
If that's a society they lived in back then, I don't know. But is that the relationship you have with your God?
So what did you come up with when you try to control people with money or ideas?
Human beings tend to want a predictable life. You know, and we want to control when things become unpredictable. And so I guess we do whatever we can possibly do to try to control things. It's our temptation. We do it at an individual level. We do it at a community level. Do it at the national level.
But that's necessary to a point. When does it become wrong? That's why I buy insurance.
Right.
Is that wrong?
You're controlling the outcome.
Probably not. Yeah, so how do we interpret flee from idolatry?
But you know, strictly speaking, insurance would be a prime example of how you try to be in control of unpredictable things.
It's been taught in the past that God's sovereign, and you're buying insurance to stand between you and his sovereignty, because he wants you sick and you don't want to get sick.
So I think another key point is throughout Paul is not talking about life in general in these passages. He has a point. His point is the church's effectiveness to mission. That's the overall context. So the default position is full identification in all aspects of life. The caveat is practices that touch upon the mystical, which are reminders of the true God, these you may participate in for the right reasons. This is partial identification. The exception to full identification is practices that misrepresent God's characters, practices that elevate a thing or ritual over God, and practices that invoke or appeals to divinity of any kind as a means of control over another. These things do not participate in. No. In other words, no identification. And not only do not participate, but flee from these things. At least that's what I think Paul is saying. The issue has been singular. The Corinthians were arguing for the right to attend pagan feasts and were trying to, quote, build up others by having them attend as well. Paul says no. Not only is the latter action totally unloving, and Christian behavior is based on love, not knowledge, but the action itself is totally incompatible with life in Christ as it is celebrated at the Lord's table. Modern Christianity, especially in the West, tends to kind of discount this mystical spiritual realm. For Paul, it was very real.
And you never dismissed it.
No. And you know, maybe we need to take that more seriously, or at the very least, consider the subjective experience.
In other words, we need more candles.
No, not necessarily.
But not necessarily not.
Not necessarily not, right.
Yeah.
What we need to understand is that not everything can be explained objectively. We also need to realize that participation and exposure to different ideas that run counter to God's nature can affect us for evil.
But being that our church and state are so separate, and our holidays, our community functions are pretty much sterile from the spiritual sense, aren't we kind of benign to this?
Well, I think that gets to the problem that we don't, you know, there are idolatry needs to be redefined and understood differently.
By us.
Right.
Who kind of tend to dismiss the whole thing because we don't identify with it.
Right.
Okay, so where is there idolatry? I mean, I can see idolatry in when I give my offerings. Is it out of obligation and insurance, or is it out of thankfulness? Is it out of faith, like you're trying to say? But I'm a redneck. I really don't do too much out of obligation.
Well,
I pay my taxes out of personally, I do it out of respect because I appreciate this country I live in. I would like to pay less, but I really do not begrudge what I pay. For what I get, I think I'm getting a bargain, looking at third world countries or whatever. But
I would say formulaic presentations of salvation would be idolatry.
I don't know what
formulaic. There's a formula. If you go through these steps, if you say these right words in the right order, then you're saved.
And we have thrown the rosary out so vehemently on that basis that we have failed to see the value of the rosary is no different than the communion. Because some people do it just out of a form of meditation. They sit every night and they look at the nice garden and just meditate. And so what I think I'm hearing Paul say is it's not the rosary that's wrong. It's what you put into the rosary. You can go to communion and drink your wine in faith that Jesus is your advocate. Or you can go to communion and drink the wine obligating Christ to fulfill his commission.
So you're saying that this sentence prayer of a sinner coming to Christ is like an idol?
It can be. It's
because now you have said the words and you're in control, you're safe.
Yeah.
And you're saying you're saving yourself, where it's not you that save yourself, it's God who saved you already.
Right.
So if you're putting faith in those words, then it kind of looks like an idol that you, it's something that, anything that you think you can do maybe is an idol to save yourself. Instead of recognizing that it's God who saves you, not anything you do.
Yeah.
So if you think you have done stuff to control your future, that stuff probably is idols to you.
It may be. It has to do with trying to invoke God's power.
So, I guess you said I was wrong in reading this to
throw
communion and the Lord's Supper, etc. out.
Yeah.
Am I wrong to use this to throw the rosary out?
Probably.
And maybe you could be wrong to throw out this sentence, prayer. How does that sentence go?
I don't know.
You know, maybe it is good words to say the sinner's prayer.
It may be, but you know, there are some churches where it has to be this exact sentence said precisely. Otherwise, you are not saved. You cannot be saved, and that is magic.
I understand, but the Catholic Church, I understand, would like to have the priest available at the moment the individual passes, right? There's nothing wrong with that.
But it's like magic that...
It depends what people put, or may have put on it. And so I'm thinking that the rosary may have come of good or ill, but it's up to the individual to decide what they're doing with it, rather than a third party pointing fingers at them.
Is there lots of different things they say with the rosary, or just do you just say Hail Mary, Hail Mary, Hail Mary?
I do not know.
I know. Should have asked Posey what she says.
Or is that what they do? I don't know what they do. I honestly don't. But what I'm saying is, I think for myself, I need to back off on judging others, because my rituals, it's the attitude I take toward them that makes a difference. And their rituals, it's the attitude they take towards it, not my judgment of their ritual. That's what I think I need to back off.
Yeah, and that's part of the partial identification, because within Christianity, most rituals can be interpreted in many ways. Now, Paul talked about communion. He condemned the Corinthians for looking upon communion in a magical way, although he did not condemn communion itself. Now, when it came to pagan sacraments, Paul said, flee from those things, because it is participation
in magic.
Yeah. In the completely wrong kind of spiritual reality.
And if they're seeing you give obeisance to idols, you can't come over here and give obeisance to God.
If you take a common thread to everything we always have said from the very beginning, is you cannot remove the mind that God gave you to use your mind, because there's no absolutes in the concrete stuff. You've got to think beyond the absolutes. And so it's easy to divide ritual, this. But reality has nothing to do with that. The reality has to do with their thinking, their faith, what their...
And there was a lot going on there. They were emotionally all wrapped up in their culture, and that's what it was.
That, and suppose, let's dismiss the reality of demons for the sake of argument. It would still be a problem, because for the Corinthians, the subjective reality was, first of all, that demons are real. The second problem is that their relationship to these pagan deities, the demons, by being in the presence of those things, it would influence how they viewed their God, the Christian God.
Well, the premise of magic is control, and that's the whole point.
So they would be influenced to try to control the Christian God.
So wasn't that the sin of Achan?
Can
whether it's opened up a small.
That was Korah.
Korah.
Yeah.
So would that be they were putting wrong
they,
emphasis on wrong syllable.
They offered strange fire. Mm-hmm. Who knows what exactly their motivations were. But they thought the ritual was what was important.
David poked fun at that when he took the sword out of the food off of the from the priest and the
temple. Right. Yeah.
So, beginning, Paul said, sensible people.
So, what can we equate that with today? You said it can be anything we think is just magically evoking God to do something for us, or trying to control people. Is that all we've come up with?
I think one of the keys is this illegitimate versus legitimate power. Now, some things are legitimate. Now, if you're a manager in a business with employees, you have legitimate power over those employees.
And you need to keep things under control. Or you have infection.
Or as citizens of this community, state, and nation, you know, we have granted power to certain entities. And when they say something, we are obligated to follow them. Illegitimate, I think, has to do with the manipulation aspect.
Abuse of that.
Abuse, manipulation.
In our culture, for some reason, it appears, and I'm sure I'm blind to my own blindness, but it appears like we've weeded that out. But I can see in others that could be very prevalent.
It's very prevalent in religious situations.
Oh, yeah, but we've kind of walked away from a lot of that.
We think we've walked away from a lot of that.
We're blind to our blindness.
Because remember, in the Corinthian church, maybe some of them were trying to find excuses to participate at pagan events. But really, Paul's problem is with the church itself. There were factions trying to manipulate one another, trying to exert control of one another, claiming Paul, Apollos, Cephas, the name of Christ even, saying, we're right.
I follow so-and-so.
And you're wrong.
I follow so-and-so.
It's causing divisions. Or saying to the strong, we're saying to the weak, well, if you don't do as we say, then no, you're not really spiritual.
Do we do that?
No, because we know, we have the secret knowledge about from God about what's really right.